Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story, Canada's longest-running daily news podcast. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story straight from the people who broke it. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday starting April 22nd, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Find your frequency.
Controversial subjects with the facts can be tense, but we are Ace Up Science here to make things make sense.
Today we are talking with Audrey Tong, a Taiwanese genius in the field of tech who is also considered one of the thought leaders in AI and also happens to be one of the first non-binary politicians. Super exciting interview, but first we're talking about the pill for
birth control
as well as eye contact and what it says about you.
Wow.
I can never remember everything at once, okay? We're just in Taiwan. I'm so jet-lagged. My brain's not functioning, okay?
No, no, that's a very fair excuse. The 12-hour difference, some might even say 13-hour difference. You're good.
Yeah, some would say 13 because that's actually the amount it is.
It is such a cool interview. Audrey Tong was the coolest part about going to Taiwan.
They were so interesting. The interview was so fascinating, and even just hanging out with them was like a really cool
and
experience.
They have tangible information about how to be happier in the world of the internet and tech that I think is so interesting.
Yeah.
I'm edging y'all for that conversation, but I was like, I actually we need to change a lot of our lives, and I was obsessed with them and obviously happy to have been in Taiwan, but I don't know. There was something about her and talking to her that I thought was
it was eye-opening. Yeah. And they literally were considered a genius since they were 5 years old.
Yeah, they read complicated novels when they were five, and they learned code when they were six. I tried to ask them that off the beginning of the interview, and it was almost they're so smart that they were trying to explain their child genius life, and it was just it's not even registering because they're just
I'm I still don't know what any of that means.
Exactly. You're she said the type of code she learned when she was six, and I was just I don't know what that is, but I don't want to ask.
Yeah, I know.
It was wild.
But yeah, we had a great time in Taiwan, but truly, before I went and coming home, I was researching how to deal with jet lag. What are the best strategies? What can you do? Nothing works, just so you know. Being old also definitely doesn't help.
Yeah, what works is time, and it's hell. But it's whatever, it's a privileged type of hell.
I just don't remember it happening to me so strongly when I was younger and been to these places, but maybe, I don't know.
You're older, you just said it.
I know, but no is offense. That really it? Is that,
yeah. Yeah, I think so. I've talked to people about it, and they were you're old now. Oh my God. Friends.
Just actually was crazy.
Yeah.
And now that we're home, I'm just re-experiencing it all again, and it's we're on day four or five, and I'm just when does this go away?
Yeah, no, it's you'll need another week. But let's get into what we learned this week.
Okay.
Oh, what did we learn this week?
So I learned about how the birth control pill makes you less horny, which I was like, what? The actual pill itself makes women's libido go down. And some doctors and people think it's could have permanent damage of low sex drive.
Well, even after taking, after stopping.
And I was like, imagine a male birth control pill that caused low sex drive, like that would be absolutely
like revolution in the streets.
There would be full revolution. The TikTok bros would be like the endless video. Joe Rogan would be like crying. Like, oh. But the reason it's not sort of been considered an issue is because the FDA doesn't consider sexual behavior like a meaningful enough side effect.
I see, because it's kind of like, it's not like, oh, it's giving you a sickness or a disease.
Yeah.
They categorize that
but
separate.
But now, again, it's like, are you kidding? That's like, men are designing their lives around their sex drive. Like,
yeah,
it's,
and that should like
something
be on the box.
Yeah, it should definitely
to
be
at
on
least
the box.
So you know, like, you don't have to feel any kind of way, or at least understanding, okay, this is a symptom, and if that's happening to me, I can kind
at least
of
understand
know
yeah
where it's coming from.
And it's your sex drive is the lowest in the middle of your cycle, but essentially what it is like the pill has estrogen, progesterone in it that obviously affects testosterone. But if you have a vagina, testosterone is the hormone that controls your libido. Mm. So there's a protein that gets triggered to increase when you take the pill. It's called the sex hormone binding globulin. And this protein decreases testosterone in the body. Mm. So women take the pill, they have decreased testosterone. This causes and can cause a lower libido, decreased sex drive. And they're now thinking it could have like lifelong damage to your sex drive. Is
that
crazy?
Wild.
I know. I was reading this like, what? Apparently doctors will tell you, but like, I don't know. It's the pill. You need it. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I obviously, as a gay man, I feel so far removed from like, I feel like probably even straight men know more about this than I do. Just because like their partners or girlfriends or whatever would have to be taking it. Not have to, but you know what I mean? So I'm just like, I actually don't, I don't even have a baseline.
Yeah, maybe people are like, yeah, I know, like, it makes me less horny. And but then I'm just sitting there like, what? But it's
I find that interesting that you were like, it's not considered a side effect. That's
it's just another example of like truly science just being completely like ignoring the female experience. Like,
yeah,
if it's just a classic sexist, if the tables were turned, like the pill would have been updated and modified years ago if men were losing their sex drive.
And I get why like a woman would want to, or like a female would want to take their own bodily autonomy in some cases, but it's also like there should be a version for men. I still understand why there should be a version for females to like be able to take themselves and know it's like on their own accord. Yeah. But I'm like, it definitely science could have figured this out. And it's like, just like kill the sperm.
Yeah.
Okay, mine is about eye contact, which I know a lot of people have a challenge with. I'm curious, like, you know, I like
are
to start mine with the question.
Flip
what's
the table?
Your relationship to eye contact, Greg?
Oh, this is such a loaded question. I'm good with eye contact as long as it's not being addressed.
As soon as someone's like, look at me.
Or like, as soon as I start thinking I'm looking in someone's eyes, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I definitely think it's something I'm like, there are people who are like eye contact forward and they make me uncomfortable.
I think you're not alone. And so this was a study that was looking into how common eye contact, now we're staring at each other,
eye contact actually
is, and how it impacts relationships and like behavior. So they basically, in this study, it's from McGill, which is like in Montreal near us.
Whoa, gorgeous university.
They realized people only look at each other's faces simultaneously 12% in a conversation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But they only make eye contact simultaneously 3.5% of the time. So like you might look at somebody's mouth or their forehead.
Normal.
Yeah, but when you realize like what eye contact, you think as a species it's so important, but only 3.5% of a conversation do people make eye contact.
Yeah, also you just pointed at me while doing that. It was so scary.
Well,
really
intense.
Like, isn't it like threatening to like in dogs and stuff? Like, don't you think there could be like a threatening vibe?
Maybe, yeah. Like, it's obviously
evolutionary.
Like,
obviously, we're not just like
and
gazing.
Even when they're like, you see clips of people like being around gorillas, they're like, do not make eye contact. Like, you have to like, look at the ground.
Yeah, like it doesn't seem that odd to me.
It says when they did look at each other's faces, they looked equally often at the mouth and eye region.
Yeah, I love looking at the mouth.
And there was very little mutual eye-to-eye contact. So, like, you could look at someone's eyes quickly and they're not looking at yours. But
okay, that makes me feel way better.
So what they found interesting was the time spent looking directly into each other's eyes predicted where their eyes would go next. So it was like when people looked at each other's eyes, they were more likely to if I look at your eyes, I'm more likely to follow where your eyes go next.
Okay.
So yeah. I, to me, I'm like, I don't totally understand what that implicates, but they were like, from when people would make eye contact, we could predict where they would next look based off of the partner.
Yeah, that makes sense. You would look where the other person's looking.
Yeah. So there's like some sort of level of connection where now suddenly once we've done this behavior of eye contact, we are like connected in a way that our behavior after that is much more predictable. Which I thought was interesting. They're like, overall summary said, humans engage in looking patterns towards different face parts during interactions with direct eye-to-eye looks occurring relatively infrequently. However, social messages relaying during eye-to-eye contact appear to carry key information that propagates to affect subsequent individual social behavior.
That is so annoying. I hate when studies are so complicated. It's like, literally, they're just saying, oh, we found that they kind of looked in the same direction sometimes after they looked at each other. And it's also like, that doesn't mean that you're connected.
Not connected, but it's interesting to be able to predict a behavior.
Yes, yes.
So if you're, it's not very predictable until that moment, they're like, we can predict with pretty good accuracy where they'll look next.
Science is so annoying sometimes. I'm like, speak English. Actually, we talked about that with Audrey Tong about AI and how it might implicate science communication and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get into it. It's so good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're excited for you guys to hear this interview.
I want to listen to it.
Yeah.
Again.
Me too. I'm excited.
Take notes because there's some important information.
Yeah. Especially about like tech interactions. Yeah,
the stylist.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll take a break and come back with Audrey Tong.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you so much for being here. We're so happy to chat
with
you.
We're obsessed with you.
Yes. We heard a rumor that when you were very young, maybe even 5 years old, you were already considered like a genius reading very complicated works. Is this true?
Just the Tao Te Ching.
Okay. But do you have a memory of like doing complicated math and stuff at that age?
Yeah, around 6 or 7. And I love mathematics, but I didn't like math at all.
Really?
So when I was 8 years old and I discovered this thing called a computer that can do all the math for me and then leave me to do the mathematics, I was so excited, except we didn't have a computer at home, right? So I just put out an A4 paper and drew with a pen the QWERTY keyboard, and then use a pencil. Every day I just wake up and I type CLS, enter. And just erase that. That was when I was 8 years old.
Wow.
And after a few weeks doing that, my parents just, you know, gave me a personal computer.
Yeah, they're like, I think it's time to... So that was just sort of in your nature from when you were young. You just felt compelled and interested in it from the get-go.
Yeah, definitely. And for the longest time, I would just, you know, play a video game, maybe in some friend's home and so on, and just go back home and just recode that video game from scratch.
Wow.
What? Oh my god.
And figured out how to like recreate them.
Right.
Learn how to actually code.
Well, nowadays language model do that quicker, right? But that was formative.
Yeah. Wow. Like, do you think that is something, when it comes to like people learning new skills, learning things, do you think it's best to hone in on what naturally interests you? Or do you think that people can, somebody who maybe thinks they don't like mathematics, if they try hard enough, is it the path they should go? Like, is it best to follow your instinct or follow what you want to do?
And I think both actually work together, because if you work on the time-saving part, like things that I want, then it leaves more time to pursue the intrinsic motivations, like things that I love, right?
Yeah.
It's only when we forget this balance do we get into, you know, sucked into a job that just does the routine work, or just close off in one's own world without interacting with the external world. And what I love about programming is that it is like notes to a melody that shapes how people interact. So to me, computation is fundamentally social or belongs to a community. When I write a video game, I share it with the kids that I knew back in the 90s, and people really loved how they can learn mathematics easier by playing the video games that I coded. I think the first one I coded was learning fraction numbers by placing balloons on a number line. And then you can guess where the balloon is, like two-third or 2/3. Right. And then there's a dart shooting that point, and you would be off by a little bit. And so you basically learn the fraction numbers very easily.
Yeah. Wow, you made math fun.
That is a challenge for a lot of people. Has that always been part of your interest to make things accessible to others?
Yeah. Definitely, yes. And also, I think equally important is that I didn't attend formal education after when I was 14 years old.
So I'm really?
A junior high dropout, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Wow. So like literally everything I learned after that came from the internet.
Wow.
From open access and so on. So without open access, I wouldn't exist in my current form.
But you started to work at a young age, right? Like in, where did you work in when you were?
15. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, what was your first, like, what were the first
CTO of a search engine company.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
I'm curious about your thoughts around open access. Obviously, that's like transformed the world. The internet has transformed the world in so many ways. Do you see that as like a fundamental shift in society, allowing people who maybe otherwise don't have access to things to suddenly be able to learn so much that they would have to pay a lot for, maybe?
Exactly. Yeah, so before the internet, when we talk about neighborhood or neighbors, it means people who are physically close to us. But now after the internet, it means that people who share our values. Right. So with some commitments into maybe adjusting sleep patterns, you can be in a community with a very distributed constituency anywhere around the world that share a interest in science, in communication, and so on, become more like kinsfolk or tribe, even compared to people who are physically close to you.
Yeah.
I feel like this may be jumping a little bit ahead of the conversation, but I'm curious about your thoughts around, you know, so many of us are connected by the internet now, and we live in these digital spaces, which can be really fun, and you can learn so much. But in some ways, we hear about people sometimes feeling disconnected from the real world, like maybe missing some of that in-person community. Do you think about that? Like, is there some type of balance we need to focus on to make sure we're getting that in-person neighborhood connection as well as our digital neighborhood connection?
Yeah. I found that the only thing that keeps me isolated from the physical closeness is touch screens. So I don't have any problem putting down my computer or my phone if I'm operating through a stylus or a mouse or a keyboard. Because these are intentional, right? I think about where I need to point and click, and then I go ahead and point and click on it. But with touch screens, it becomes very difficult because after a while, my brain thinks the screen is part of my limb, and it starts scrolling me.
Right.
Right. So there's even a word for that, doom scrolling.
Yes.
Right? So people literally cannot put it down.
So you see a differentiation between the touch screen technology and the technology that involves like a stylus, like a physical barrier, like a mouse?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I started, I think, with Palm Pilot and Sharp Zorus and Galaxy Note and now the Fold. So all the devices that I have with me have a stylus.
Is that for your own? That's so interesting to me. Is it for your own ability to be able to put it down? And because it just feels like more easy in some ways because there's a physical barrier? Is that what you mean?
No, it's the intentionality.
Yeah.
With a stylus. You cannot accidentally doom scroll.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's like you're,
Oh my God.
It's like we need to adopt this philosophy.
Okay, so you always interact with something and that physical barrier makes it easier for you to not get caught up in that sort of like, you know, mending your mind with your my phone, which I use my thumb with.
Yes.
Oh my God. Yes.
And it's a different social cue, right? Because if I like unfold my phone and start using the stylus, this is a social invitation. Right, this is like when I'm scribbling on my notebook, and it's open for you to see. So you're implicitly invited.
Whereas when you're holding the phone in front of you,
it's a microaggression. Right?
Yeah. Oh my God, I think that's so interesting.
Me too.
And I'm like, I need a stylus.
We're going to get a stylus right after this.
Okay, so thinking about AI, actually, I guess I could go back a little bit. The idea of sort of like the internet being this place that, like what you were saying, you can have a neighborhood that isn't necessarily something physical, kind of like positive aspects of the internet. I feel like we've lived through a time where we thought it was a really positive thing. Mm-hmm. And it feels like in more recent times, it's become more of a challenge. Mm-hmm. The idea of this, the internet being this positive open place. Do you feel the same way? Do you notice that there was a shift for you at all as someone who's been so involved with tech and the internet? Did you feel like there was a time where you thought, oh my God, something's going wrong or I need to figure out how to help this thing be what I thought it could be?
No, that's a great question. And as I mentioned, touchscreen really changed everything.
Wow.
Yeah. What? So around 2013, 14, people were discovering that it's actually easier to be polarized and hate each other on internet compared to the previous era, where it is actually takes a deliberate intention to start a flame war. But around 2014, people started to discover, which with touchscreens, it's actually easier to start a flame war or outrage compared to friendship or whatever online. And that's first because people were being scrolled by their screens. So they were operating in this fast system, not a slow system of deliberate syncing. And also because the touchscreens are so small, there's literally no context to hold both sides. So even if you have a long form content, you'll scroll to one region, and which is by definition out of context. Right.
Oh my God. So you really think that it has a physical, it's even going back to what you said earlier, it's that touchscreen aspect is what you think physically changed things.
Touchscreen and smaller screens.
Oh my God. That's so, I don't know. That's so interesting because that's like such a specific answer I did not expect.
Do you think then that is an important consideration for design of the technologies we use? Like coming from producers of technology, is that something that should be thought, put more thought into?
Yeah, at the time, I'm working as a interaction designer and engineer in SocialText. SocialText was a company in Silicon Valley that takes like wiki or microblogging or really anything that happens in the community of the internet and repurpose it for enterprise work, in the flow of work. So think Slack or collaborative documents or spreadsheets, and we've been doing that since like 2006, 2008. And so when I worked on that and on the SocialText mobile experience, we found that the push notifications is the most dangerous mix in addition to the touch screen and the small screen.
Because it takes your mind away.
Exactly. It forces a context shift. And so at the time, we work on SocialText Signal, which is its own mobile app. And we discovered that if you turn push notification on and you only have SocialText Signal on your phone, it increases your productivity. But as soon as you have another message system, Yammer or whatever, on your phone, then the productivity just plummets.
So because, now there's so many on our phone.
Right, exactly.
So many different like push notifications taking your brain all over.
That's right.
Wow. That's
interesting. It's interesting to think about how something can be very useful in the context of like a singular form, but as it starts to interact and compete with other forms of the same thing, it causes bigger problems.
Right, exactly, exactly. So, which is why I intentionally choose a phone that folds into an iPad and a pad, really, the fold screen, and that I disable push notification and I only interact with it with a stylus. So it's the three layers of defense. Even if I like fall into the bad habit on one side, it's not as addictive as when it's combined to a cocktail. So I can always get out of the trance, so to speak.
Oh my God, this is blowing my mind. I'm like, I need to practice all of those things.
I'm curious what you think about what people can do about this. Like, is it is the best practice to think about it for yourself? Yeah. Or is this something that
needs to be regulated?
Yeah, or like companies need to think about a little more in terms of protecting citizens and making sure that we can be like productive and have autonomy over our time.
No, definitely. And so let me try this again. Definitely. And what we've seen is that when combined with precision targeted advertisements, it fuels a cycle where people are distracted, into something that may be a financial scam or things like that, because people, when they're distracted, are more easily scammed,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. persuaded, right? So precision persuasion is like borderline illegal or even criminal, like financial scams thrive on this environment. Mm. Whereas if it is a very large screen and with keyboard, it's far less likely really? For people to fall into this cryptocurrency scams right. and so on. We have actually seen, for example, on Facebook, not to single it out, but on Facebook, there are people who place like deepfaked advertisements of a political figure, a public figure, saying that, oh, I earn so much in crypto right. or investing in something. And just because, you know, people are just scrolling, doom scrolling, see a face they recognize, and they just click through and start, you know, getting scammed. So we actually passed a law this year in Taiwan that says if Facebook, after we notice it, that there is such a deepfake financial scam and they don't take it down, and somebody get conned for like $1 million or whatever, then Facebook is also liable for wow. that $1 million. So this is a kind of re-internalizing the right. negative effect it has on society.
Do you think that there's a future where the, like, you're obviously talking about doom scrolling, and I'm relating because mm-hmm. I'm like mm-hmm. in my life finding it hard to get off my phone and live my mm-hmm. life and be happy. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a future where it becomes such an issue for so many people that what the things you're describing become mm-hmm. the solution? Mm-hmm. Or do you think it involves regulation like you're describing from the government to help mm-hmm. regulate people mm-hmm. into better habits? Like, do you feel like in the future mm-hmm. we might end up there on our own, or do you think it needs mm-hmm. to be, it's too powerful that we have to regulate it?
Yeah, I think when there is a clearly identified social harm and re-internalizing the liability doesn't cause extra harm, right? It's difficult to say that if we hold Facebook liable for this kind of financial scams, what kind of progress will it hinder or stifle? Can't really think of a yeah. counter-argument, right? Yeah. So when people understand the harm that it's causing, just like back when, many decades ago in my youth, there was this Montreal Protocol against the Freon, right? The refrigerating compound that destroys yeah. the ozone.
Yeah.
And everybody understand refrigeration is a great thing. It's right. a great invention. But a replacement that doesn't destroy ozone have not been invented. Mm-hmm. But once people start realizing there's a direct causation between Freon and depletion of ozone, people nevertheless committed to replace that maybe decades in the future and reinvest into inventing new compounds that doesn't destroy the ozone. And ozone is mostly healed now. Right?
Yeah.
So I think using that as a powerful example, we need to treat our fabric of trust and frankly our sanity as yeah. some kind of an ozone that cannot yes. be depleted.
That's a really great metaphor for an analogy for like all these problems. I think, as Greg was kind of saying, when we first started working on the internet, which is about 12 years ago now, it just felt so exciting. It felt like the bastion of all this information, and we were so excited. And we're kind of in an age now where I think people are a little scared mm-hmm. because everything's transforming so fast. You talked about deep fakes, like the ability for even me, who considers myself like highly educated, good at the internet, mm-hmm. can be tricked by something yeah. like this. To know that there's kinds of solutions out there and systems we can create to kind of catch them. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, do you think the speed at which the technology mm-hmm. seems to be changing now is manageable for us? Or do you have hope around like mm-hmm. how we can make sure that these kinds of things are looked after?
Yeah, I think the science and technology speed is overwhelming for any single individual and has been so since the printing press.
Fair.
So yeah. it's not a new problem.
Everyone's freaking out no matter what.
Yeah, so I think the difference, right, is whether technologies that increases collective sense making, so coordinating to identify problem like the ozone depletion, is that accelerating faster than the disruptive right. kind of technologies. Yeah. If they are kept in tandem, then of course I have a firm belief in democracy mm-hmm. being not a problem but a solution.
Right.
Right. So it's just that our current democratic process doesn't have enough bandwidth. It's just a few bits every 4 years uploaded by each person, right? So like very small bandwidth, very high latency, like every 2 years. But if we do this continuously, we can very quickly identify common issues and also brainstorm solutions to it just in the here and now. And this is really our trick in overcoming the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We've not had a single day of lockdown where people cannot move across cities throughout the 3 years. And that's because people learned epidemiology by this every 2 p.m. Science channel.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, held by our health minister. And anyone can ask questions by just calling 1-822. And the top frequently asked questions get answered next 2 p.m.
Wow, that's so cool.
So something as simple as that.
Right.
Actually equip the society with the capability to innovate, to counter each mutation of the virus, which is going even faster than technology.
Right, yeah.
that's a scientific fact.
Yes.
So that kind of makes me think about AI. Mm-hmm. And because I feel like that is sort of the place we're at now, I think in the science community, that's a huge discussion. Is like, in all communities, like AI seems to be infiltrating everything and obviously happening fast. So in your opinion, like thinking of that sort of metaphor of like advancing, but trying to keep it in tandem, like in a place that's good, like where do you feel it's at now? Maybe starting, what do you think are the most positive benefits of AI? And then we're gonna talk about like the risks.
Yeah, definitely. I think it used to be that we can only closely collaborate with people who we already somewhat share a culture with. And with people with very different culture, very different language, a very different worldview, it's okay to maybe do some transactions or voting together or things like that. But it's much harder to just, you know, talk about the community issues because people approach it from very different perspectives. But with AI, what I'm most excited about is that it models the language and therefore some of the worldviews or assumptions in the language. So I literally can plot a visualization of what people are talking about AI, people who concerns about safety, about progress, about democratic participation, and just visualize, reflect back that common communal viewpoint and synthesize them as avatars and talk to those avatars and so on, and ask AI to find the common ground, to build a bridge, to find statements that people on both sides agree with. And I call this plurality or collaborative diversity.
So using AI to actually understand where opinions come together on either side or...
Yes, and we actually run a lot of those conversations and also in conjunction with the Collective Intelligence Project, work with Anthropic and OpenAI and other top labs. Anthropic used this process to ask a statistically representative 1,000 people in the US to co-create a constitution for AI of how it should behave and compare it to the default Claude, which is the Anthropic version written by the researchers and found that they're equally powerful, but the people's AI shows much less bias.
Because it's reflective of actually.
Right, exactly, the communities, and this is great because this is the first major transformative technology that you can tune it just by talking to it. You can't say that about refrigeration, right?
Yeah. So you're talking about AI as in like the concept of everyone being able to sort of write or talk to a specific technology and then have it sort of meld all the information together, because it's a complicated thing. I don't know how that works. Meld the information together to create like a statement or a concept that mixes everyone's opinion.
For citation purposes, this is called coherent blended volition.
Coherent blended volition is the is you
a
would
technical
call that?
Term. Yeah.
Wow.
And this is one example, and this is public website, so you can screen cap it later. Right. So this is
talk back, to the city.
Yeah. So this is back when Twitter was still called Twitter. This early April, and the talk to the city team. This is open source, by the way. Just found a snapshot of the Twitter sphere. Each one is one tweet that talks about these clusters. And it not only summarizes into a kind of executive summary, it can actually let you drill down to anything and start a conversation with that cluster.
And this is just using people's tweets.
Yes, exactly.
So there's not even an asking them to say their opinion about something. It's just something they've already decided to say.
Yeah, exactly. And this is another example. So this is, instead of AI, it's talking about the prison system in Michigan. So the local community organizer interviewed a lot of returning citizens about their experience. Now, when we talk about preferences, actually individuals don't have a fixed preference outside of their communities. It is only when anchored on, say, returning citizens, that people have a cohering blended volition that we can actually trace back, so there's no confabulation. Mm. Like each and every thought is something that someone said,
right.
Actually wow. said. And then you can start a full screen map and show exactly the same kind of cluster, and you can synthesize into a communal voice.
So this is the positive aspects of AI. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This is using AI to understand people better.
Exactly.
And that goes back to your point of how different communities have different needs and desires. Different cultures may come from different perspectives.
That's right.
Do you think in a more increasingly globalized world, like how do we manage for some cultures being extremely different, having different belief systems, but as we like meld together more and more, is there just like higher level AI systems?
Yeah, recursively, right? So the idea is just to build those cultural translators. And so we can augment it with immersive technologies, like literally living in each other's shoes for a while and so on. And in my ministry, we have an annual event called the Ideathon. So like hackathon, but not code, right? But ideas. And one of the winning ideas this year is exactly about, you know, living in the synthetic avatar of this community's shoes so that you can just put on VR or whatever and see things literally from their viewpoint and just be in that community for a while.
So that maybe like what are the more scary negative aspects of AI, because that's a really positive take on AI.
Yeah,
I feel it's like people,
any technology, you know, there's the good and the bad that comes along. What are the more worrisome or things that we as societies need to be aware of and look out for and plan for in terms of AI? Do you see another angle of that?
Yeah, so I talk about this continuous democracy, but AI poses a severe threat to the traditional representative democracy because if you just manage to deeply persuade people the night before the election or the night after the election that the election didn't go as you know that people intended, then as we have seen in some democratic countries, it really fractures the society. It is now much easier to mount this kind of what we call information integrity attacks.
So why is that through AI? I don't understand how it becomes easier because what, like, what's an example?
Yeah. So an example would be, as I mentioned, to con someone with a financial scam in a certain community, it used to be that you have to speak the language and understand the culture and also find someone who is believable enough.
Right.
But all these has been overcome by AI.
Wow.
You don't even need to speak a language or live in that culture, right? You can just say your script and ask a generative AI to say this the way Audrey would say in their local culture.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very profound example.
It's much easier to be targeted by someone who otherwise would maybe not be able to target.
Right, so we talk about cultural translation and bridge making, but what's to cross that bridge?
Yeah.
Right.
So there's also, like, if you think about the use of AI, like, those are both examples about like society and elections and democracy. But then I think in the science field, there's a lot of concern about like realistic fake scientific studies. Mm-hmm. And like truly like in the positive aspect would be that maybe you could get a really intelligent professor to say, rewrite my paper in a way that people could understand. Mm. Like our job becomes obsolete, but that's a good thing for the public. Like there's a positive aspect of science information.
Yeah.
But then the negative aspect is that you could just like actually create fake studies and then trick people.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel like AI in every field of the world can kind of have that positive or negative thing and we're just at the precipice of like deciding where it goes?
Yeah, generative AI is quite different from the previous AI, which are more narrow in nature. Generative AI, like a language model, that models the language, excels when you ask it questions that it can answer by its understanding of language alone. So content translation that we just talked about is one very good example. Even across modalities, like with this article, produce this video or image or things like that. Or summarization, which is also all the output information can be found in the input information.
Yeah.
So the demo I showed you is summarization from very long videos into the community voices.
Yeah.
So things that are equal or reducing in information, compression basically, are the best uses of language models. Mm-hmm. But there are many people who use it the other way. Right. So literally asking it to make things up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if you ask it to write a convincing, you know, propaganda in the style of a politician and so on, your question is very short, but you expect thousands of words.
Yeah.
In which case the generative model has no other choice but to make things up.
To make things up.
Right.
Interesting, because now I'm realizing that how similar that my example about science is. It's still all generative and still language based and still about summarizing, or what you said, like opposite of summarizing. So I thought it was so different in my head, but it's actually not. So AI has a specific function, really. It really is about that. It's about language, summarizing, and then information at this point.
Exactly. And there's very exciting research. It's works like a lie detector for neural systems, so that whenever AI feels the urge to make things up, its neurons fire in a different pattern. And so we can actually...
That's real?
Yeah, that's real. No, for this kind of frontier systems, you can now, if you can inspect its activation patterns, there's a clear distinction between things that are from the original input set, so they can just answer truthfully, or truthfully saying, I don't know. And the pathways that are when it's making things up.
Yeah. That's so crazy.
So is that solution to, because obviously many people are worried about, like, especially we're in this age of information and now that so much information can be made so quickly. In your mind, do you see the solution as creating these other systems that try to hold these systems
It's like, you know, refrigeration chemical agents that doesn't destroy the ozone.
Yeah.
Like, how do we put in the effort to find a solution? Even if we don't have it right now, we know what the problem is.
Exactly.
Working towards solving that problem.
Right, because there's a lot of achievements throughout the past year about rendering the output harmless. But there's comparably less achievement on keeping it honest, like not making things up. But these two are integral to information integrity. So only when we can evaluate an AI model in an open fashion, what we call collaborative red teaming. Red teaming means to get it to say dishonest things and get it to say harmful things. When we open up this kind of red teaming, we can discover vulnerabilities in the current generation of language models and hopefully quickly move to where, by default, language models should be honest and harmless. And then at that time, then we can maybe sign a Montreal Protocol and say, you know, the ozone-depleting chemical agents are just not good, you know.
Because there have been recent sort of, like, legislative meetings, like, about AI, but not much has come out of them. Like, from my understanding, just reading about them, people getting together and being like, it could be bad, it could be good. Is that where you come in? Are you someone who's trying to meet with people to try and figure out how to create a Montreal? Like, is that your goal, like, Montreal Protocol vibes of AI?
Yeah. My work with the Collective Intelligence Project, I was in the UN IGF in Kyoto. I helped crafting this open and safe joint statement around the Bletchley Park Summit and so on. And the main idea is just to shift this race to power to a race to safety. So at the moment, there's for each safety researcher in AI, there's around 30 capability researchers, right?
So trying to make like money, trying to make money, capability,
just a number of researchers.
Okay,
right. So there's much more people researching in how to make AI more powerful compared to the people who want to make AI honest and harmless.
Wow, that's scary.
Right. So we need to massively increase the investment here. Right. That's the main idea.
Interesting.
I guess like anything, like even in biology, there's always a bit of an arms race, right? This side goes, then this side has to react, then this side goes. Like even in virus control in real life and in computer life, like it's always a back and forth of. So in some ways, like you said, we're all just maybe a little afraid of the printing press right now, but hopefully it can find its way to find the solutions.
But it makes me think of the classic private versus public funding. Is safety sort of more of something that you think would be publicly funded, whereas... You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking that reminds me of the concept of relying on the private sector. To me, that means making money. I can see why there's a lot more people in that. The idea of regulation and safety to me reminds me of like publicly funded. Is that the way it kind of is right now? Like, how would you get more people involved in safety?
Well, I think most of the research and development on better refrigeration is still in the private sector, even after the Montreal Protocol.
So it was like a regulative thing from the public sector that forced the private sector to...
Exactly. So to me, this is what I call a people-public-private partnership. The people, the social sector, organizes and show very clearly. For example, recently in the U.S., we heard very clearly from the people in Hollywood that it's okay for AI to enhance writers, but it's never okay for AI to replace writers. Uh-huh. So that is something the social sector, the civil society, has very clearly signaled. And then after a few of those successful negotiation and bargaining and so on, the norm become a regulation. And the state would say, you know, anything below this standard is simply toxic. It's simply harmful to the environment. And then the race to safety means that investors will change their investment so that they will invest in things that actually improve the situation because that's where the money is now.
Wow. So if you do that throughout AI across the fields, and because it's affecting, I didn't even think about Hollywood, thinking about science. So it affects all aspects, and you have to figure out the versions of people, public, what did you call it?
The People Public Private Partnership.
Okay, yeah. That's good.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, the people have to care about these things and be informed and then make that influence in the long run. Like, even when it comes to climate change, we see, like, there's a lot of discussion around sort of this top-down versus bottom-up. You know, I as an individual shouldn't be held fully responsible for all the problems in the world, but it matters. Like, we can say, oh, certain corporations are responsible for a much bigger percentage, but it also takes me caring about that and changing my habits to ultimately change the world around us, to then change whether how the private sector might act and how the government may act in terms of those. So I guess like that people-private partnership can go across many fields.
Yeah, or we just call it collective intelligence.
Right.
So the CI approach instead of the AI approach, we can call it augmented collective intelligence, maybe ACI, just to pull it all together. Right, so the ACI, not AGI approach, is that people are experts in their community preferences. People can offer very nuanced inputs. For example, when we run alignment assemblies in Taiwan, people said very clearly they want a public option of AI. That is to say, AI that the public can fine-tune on their own and understand where all the data is coming from and things like that. And it's just like science, right? People should be able to reproduce things at home or at a lab, right? And with this strong preference, then we're having a stronger mandate now at the end of the year to do our AI evaluation center with what we call societal evaluations. So asking people to keep informing us and tuning AI models to show us where it works better. Now, the thing with either the American public that Anthropic and OpenAI work with or the Taiwanese public, it's just that when people's preferences are very nuanced, like over-reliance is a big no-no, but if we control this particular fine-tuning ability, it becomes slightly more okay and so on. In traditional polling, you can think of it as a very lossy compression, so that when it becomes a synthetic document or executive summary, all the nuance is lost.
Right.
And if you just read the headlines, right, it's just us versus them. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Even though most people agree with most of their neighbor on most of the points in a nuanced view, when you force a compression, then it becomes polarized again.
Right.
So which is why this kind of like talk to the city and so on are so important, because it's a compression that doesn't compress out the nuance.
Okay.
Wow.
This, in some ways, some of these conversations remind me, I saw an interview question of you asked once, like as a trans person, you talked about this idea of transculturalism, which I thought was really interesting. I wonder if you could talk about that a little. I think you're the first trans politician
here. The first publicly trans cabinet member in the world. Maybe everybody's in the closet.
That's true. And I just, as we've been talking about the importance of like the different kinds of cultures around the world and their positions, but also the integration of the world. I'm just curious. I would love to hear you more talk. Hear you talk more about that idea of transculturalism.
Yeah. No, I'm non-binary in everything, right? not just in gender, but also political parties and so on. Right. So the fundamental idea is that I don't think there's half of the world that's more distant from me and half the world closer to me. I don't have that instinct. I literally take all the sides. If I see a side that I cannot relate to, it's my problem, not their problem. And so I should spend more time in their culture doing a ethnographic, or really just hanging out with these people until I can argue from their viewpoint, whether it is the more than 20 national languages of Taiwan, indigenous nations, whether this is the political affiliations and so on. I feel very strongly that we should be, you know, all 17 SDG colors, not just two colors and so on. And I think this gives my style of politics a what we call credible neutrality, meaning that people would trust that if they voice their concerns, even though they're a minority, because we care about bridge making, their voice would not be compressed out. Whereas if I take any particular side, there's a natural tendency to compress out like the views outside of the Overton window, meaning that is too distant from your ideology.
So you consider yourself not non-binary outside of gender. Like people always assume of gender right now and say non-binary, but you mean it to every aspect of your life.
Right, exactly. Kind of. Yeah. Shu Wei, or digital in traditional Mandarin, also means plural. So I'm also a minister of plurality, like more than one and certainly more than two.
And you've also said you're post-gender. So what does that mean to you?
So to me, it's not that I work with people who are identified as one particular gender and consider them more close than the other people. So instead of, you know, choosing between LGBTIQA+, basically I'm just saying, you know, I'm whatever. My pronouns are whatever. If you look at my x.com profile, it literally says */*, which is internet speak for any and all.
Right.
So you can use any pronoun.
Okay. Interesting.
How do you see the importance of, like, we can see how much we can learn from, in your example, indigenous communities around the world. The same thing has happened in Canada, where for many hundreds of years it's been ignored and dismissed, and now we're realizing there's so much knowledge and information that we can gain from those communities. But at the same time, we see the world in some ways become more homogenous, more connected by the internet, and more similar. How important do you think it is to preserve those communities, to learn from them? And what do we do to preserve, whether it be language or culture or just knowledge and wisdom? How do we manage that while the world becomes more intertwined?
Yeah, just yesterday I was in the Sabadik tribe within the Paiwan Nation in the south of Taiwan. And we talked with many, the principals of the local high schools and primary schools and all that. And they all love the idea of AI that speaks their language, understand their language, translates this language, and also let their cultural tradition thrive in the internet, on the internet. That is to say, to convey their worldview in a way that would relate to other cultures. Whereas it was difficult outside of like pop culture, singers, and so on, for people to understand the full lived experience of the nation. Now it is quite easy, actually, with generative AI, because their input bits is very, very large. It's literally their lived experiences, right? So anyone can put into immersive reality or interactive gaming or things like that with a minimum of training. It used to be you have to learn Unity, Unreal Engine, or whatever, to create a kind of experience that I was describing. But now you can, you know, just skip all that. And they're very excited in working with the top AI labs here in Taiwan to fit the language models to their culture instead of shoehorning their culture into the mainstream, very large models that really only speaks the mainstream languages.
When it, like, going back to sort of the idea of being non-binary and everything, mm-hmm. I feel like it's so in our era and so what people say now, which is like everything's divided, everything's mm-hmm. binary. It feels like that's sort of, in some ways, maybe true. Like, mm-hmm. Do you find it frustrating to live in a worldview of non-binary, where as it feels like the world becomes more binary? Mm-hmm. Do you even think that's true? Do you even think the world's becoming more mm-hmm. binary?
I think there are more dimensions now. Right, so the world is becoming more intersectional. Mm. It's both easier to find our differences mm-hmm. and our similarities because the dimensions are larger and the bandwidth has increased. Mm. And so instead of focusing on the one or two main differences, which is called polarization, we can instead just focus on things that we can both live with. And there's a Leonard Cohen saying that I really love, says that there is a crack in everything, and that is how the light gets in. Mm-hmm. Right? So if we're all perfectly, you know, fungible, mm-hmm. right, then there is no communication, there's no bridge making. Mm. But exactly because there are tensions, so it gives opportunity for co-creation.
That's such a good...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is Leonard Cohen big in Taiwan? Well, Montreal boy. You like Montreal.
Yeah. That's right. No, I think there's a lot of people who in Taiwan learned about Leonard Cohen because
really?
I keep quoting Leonard Cohen.
Oh, wow. So you're the Leonard Cohen fan.
I know. Yeah. And I mean, in Taiwan, we're caught between... two tectonic plates, right? The Eurasian one and the Philippine Sea plate. And so there's like three felt earthquakes every day somewhere in Taiwan. So a lot of earthquakes. But as a result, every year, the Yushan, the top of Taiwan, grows by half a centimeter or so. Right? So this is just because it keeps bumping into one another. So without conflict, without tension, there is no co-creation. Mm-hmm. So we need to just harness this energy like the people in Wikipedia did, instead of just assuming that, you know, division is bad.
Right. I feel like that's a good way to end.
Yeah, no.
That was beautiful.
That was an amazing analogy, an amazing conversation. We appreciate your time so much. And
you're so amazing.
Yeah, we're really inspired by you. Yeah. And it's been awesome to have this conversation. So we
thank you so much.
And we feel very honored.
And come back as Taiwanese residents.
We will, yes.
We will. Oh my God, we're honored, We're going to watch that mountain grow.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Live long, prosper.
Yay!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.